This is the Warrior Poet Podcast. I am Sri. That's S-R-I. All right. This episode is what I'd call a longisode, in that it's probably a lot longer than most of my episodes, and that's for good reason. I explore in this interview with Jay Hack, who I'll introduce in a second, all sorts of topics about leadership, mentorship, things you can apply in business, things you can apply if you are coming right out of the military. Jay Hack graduated from West Point. That's the U.S. Military Academy, or USMA, as they like to say, which always sounds weird as a Navy guy or just a normal person who listens to things. He served 5 years as an infantry officer in the U.S. Army, including 1 year in Iraq during Operation Iraqi Freedom. And Jay and I were actually in the Green Zone at the same time on the same forward operating base, or FOB. And we ate lunch in the same place for as long as I was there, that deployment, which was probably 5 months. And we never met until business school, where we were in the same section at Harvard Business School. After business school, he worked in a variety of roles of corporate management, most recently as a manager for a test and measurement company. The main reason I want to talk to Jay today, besides the fact that he's a friend, a business school classmate, a former military guy like myself, is that he had a pretty unique experience that I thought would be insightful and entertaining, in that he was in Norway for 4 years in multiple roles for an oil and gas company as the only American on the ground, especially in a leadership role. And I thought that that was such a unique experience that I thought there'd be a lot of leadership lessons that we all could gain out of that. So here's my episode with Jay. This episode covers how he arrived in Norway, which is pretty funny, and topics such as mentorship and leadership. There will be a part two after this episode, and hope you enjoy. Okay, cool. So all right. Ansley was sick, and they sent her to a meth clinic. Like, can you...
When my wife and I first arrived in Norway, I moved at relatively short notice, and there was just the way our tickets fell. I had to go to a work conference the day after I got there, which was a 1 or 2 day event. And so we agreed that I would go to the work conference, and she would, see our apartment that we had, and get things kind of settled where the basic necessities were, grocery store and doctor's office and things like that. We had a 6 month, my oldest daughter was 6 months old at the time. And so we thought those things, especially around the doctor, since my daughter had a medical thing that had to be checked upon, was important. So I went to my work conference. We got into Norway. She got up and went to NAV, which is like their central directory where they help assign you a doctor and different things. Somewhere lost in the language translation, they gave her a guidance to go to this center, and so she went and went into the center, and she was, and everything looked kind of nice when she got there. They had like a full breakfast being served. They had two or three Norwegians helping, and then they had some other people who were mother and young daughter who were kind of playing around. And So the women were like, they said they greeted her in Norwegian, and she replied back in English. And they said, "Well, oh, I'm sorry. How long have you been in Norway?" She said, "I just got here yesterday." They asked her if she needed a place to stay. She said she had a place to stay. They asked if she had money for food, and she's like, "Yeah, my husband works for an oil company. We have money for food." The questions were a little bit odd. She didn't really think much of it. Then they kind of started, they kind of pulled her in another room, and they started asking her like a little bit more, like kind of just something was not quite right. They said, "Hey, how is your medical health?" And she's like, "I'm healthy." And then they said, "Well, how is your daughter's medical health?" And she's like, my daughter's healthy. And she's kind of like giving them kind of the, like, why are you asking me about my health? Like, I thought this was just a doctor's office and I was just going to come and in process. It's nice you have all this stuff, but like, you know, I just need to fill out some paperwork and leave. Then they basically, they don't, the wording in the Norwegian language is not as broad. So they basically, how it came out was, we think you're in the wrong place. And my wife's like, no, my husband has a job in Norway. We moved over here. Where, you know, this is where I'm supposed to be. And they're like, they kind of had a dialogue back and forth, and they're like, okay, we think you're in the wrong place. How long have you been using and some various types of illegal drugs? And she was like, whoa. I don't have a problem like this. I am in the wrong place. They had a nice cordial, they had a nice cordial dialogue, and she shortly left thereafter. But it's you can never. I just don't think you can ever underestimate the challenges. For every challenge that the person who's working overseas is going to have, the family is going to have equal and complex challenges that. They can't be fully appreciated. I mean, there was no way you could preconceive that you would go into that situation.
So you and I obviously have a lot of shared experience. So we were, turns out, in Iraq and Baghdad, in the green zone, literally on the same FOB at the same time. I think we figured out eating in the same chow hall during our one of our deployments. You know, you went to West Point, I went to the Naval Academy. We both went to business school together, which is great to be able to compare and contrast and share thoughts. So I think one thing just to, you know, back up a little bit is, can you talk about, you know, maybe if there's one experience from the military that like really crystallized for you what it means to be a great leader? I think that would be really helpful for people.
You know, I would say even before I joined the military, we had a I was a military dependent. My father and grandfather were both officers, and I was fortunate to be in a position where firsthand I got to see a lot of examples of what successful officers and what successful leaders look like, and. One of the best things you can do when you're figuring things out early on is to look at behavior and not only mimic behavior, but trying to understand why people are doing things, what they're doing, and understanding their motivations. I'll give you an example. The general in charge of Fort Hood, Army base with 40,000 people. He happened to be involved in one of my dad's promotion ceremonies when I was in high school. I think it was a sophomore or a junior. And I remember one of the things he did is when he was promoting my dad, before he did anything, he brought up my mother and I, and he actually spoke. He must have had his aide or something bring up some facts about us, but he spoke a little bit about us before he even spoke about my dad. And I just remember how that made me feel as a high schooler. And it's kind of, how do you articulate how you feel as a person? You know, a leader is able to bring the best out of anybody and make them feel like they're a part of something bigger than themselves in an inspirational quality, and kind of whether it's getting a person to do a task or a family member, but my pride in the Army, I wasn't even a part of the Army yet, but my pride in the Army, just being a part of that ceremony was tremendous. And it seems a very small thing, but I think what that general at the time was able to do, it was gain immense buy-in from the people that are supporting the other officer. And it's very hard for me to articulate on the podcast, but I walked away from that conversation with an immense level of pride, in a strange way, many years later, when I joined the military myself, you can derive those experiences back to positive influences you had along the way, being exposed to the military. I mean, I don't want to say he recruited me. We never even had that conversation, but by giving a positive experience and a consistent positive experience, I don't think that can be underestimated.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't know exactly how I've incorporated it, but there's one person in particular who was a year ahead of me at the Naval Academy. And it was just one thing he did, not one thing, it was his whole attitude, but there was one behavior he had, which always stuck in my mind. I have not forgotten it since. It was that even for us plebes, so he was probably, you know, sophomore or junior, whatever our old school nicknames for those were, and your West Point nicknames, I can barely remember. But, you know, essentially for people who don't know, which is probably a lot of the listeners here, the job of upperclassmen is to make the plebes, the freshmen experience trying, if you will, to probably put it lightly. And one thing he would do is, even though he was not a slouch in that regard, he, you know, applied pressure, you know, trained us, all that sort of stuff. But as we would be running through the hallways, because you got to run when you're a first year, right? Everywhere you go, unless you're in your room, he would greet every single person with a big smile and full name, you know? Even if they're like 20 of us, and just sort of like that really positive attitude and that personal connection, as simple as that was, and it struck me as odd in the beginning. I'm like, he's the only person of all the upperclassmen in our company actually doing this. And maybe he's the only one in the entire school right now who is doing this, who does this. Kind of weird, but there's just something about that consistent positive experience that just really stuck with me. And so I hope that I have applied that in some way.
There's something about how you make a person feel. And I would say it's I don't know if it's repetition or consistency, but those two things together kind of have a magic combination to influence people disproportionately. It's quite impactful. I think there's a lot to be gained by that. And I think there's something around the consistency of it too.
Right. Would love to know about a time where you screwed up and learned a lot about leadership. We've all had our share.
Mistakes new leaders make, and I think about when you start a new job or a new role, whether it's in the military or a corporation. One of the things everyone tends to focus on is, am I doing a good job? Everybody wants to succeed, by and large, and most people. You don't go to work and saying, how can I screw this up? You want to desperately succeed and you become, I would say, there's a bias towards becoming, a little bit inward focused and a bias towards, with many people, this myself included, of what can I do to make a difference right away? And, especially if you're joining an organization that's more experienced or has competent people. And so this would not apply in a crisis situation, but the question you should really ask is, how can this organization do what it needs to do to accomplish our organizational goals? And that's a little bit different question than when people ask, how can I personally do my job the best? We tend to maybe do things that may not actually be even helpful to the organization. You know, I think especially in some of the corporate America, I'll go back to my Norway example. I had people that have been doing the same job for 30 years. There's no way that from a technical competence point of view, that I would ever be able to know how to survey the welding integrity of a structure. Nor really should I, provided I have faith that the person who's working for me is competent in that area. What my job is how do I ensure that he is doing his job 100% and then some, and thinking of every possible way that we could end up failing and mitigating that. And how do I move him towards that task? How do I pull the best of him or her to do that job in the most appropriate manner possible? And how do I set those conditions for success? And I think that, again, there's a natural tendency for a new leader. I don't want to say to muddle in things, but there are plenty of problems to fix. I think it's important to understand how to fix the right ones that enable success.
That makes sense. So how do you? I've got two follow up questions based off of that. The first is, what do you think the best tools or practices are for reducing that focus on self? So whether someone is a new academy grad or a ROTC grad entering the military as an officer, whether someone is an enlisted person in their first leadership position, whether someone just graduated college and they're entering the workforce, everyone has that sense of ambition. And most people who are listening to a podcast like this are probably more ambitious than most, more type A than most. But, a lot of people will be familiar with books like Ego is the Enemy by Ryan Holiday, a book I really like and have tried to take to heart. But it's this situation where your own ambition ends up biting you more than anything else. And if you can suppress that and have that mission focus, even in a commercial, private sector environment, not only is everyone better off around you, but more often than not, I believe, or at least I would like to believe, that you'll be better off as well. Not just in terms of your promotion path or raises or anything like that, but also your own personal happiness and satisfaction. So, what have you done, or what have you seen other people do to take your leadership lesson there to heart?
The most effective way for me, and this probably differs for other people, is to find and seek out and spend time with a mentor who's gone through the similar experiences that you're mentoring, that you're going through. Let me rephrase that. So again, I would say the most successful thing I found is to go out and find a mentor who's had similar experiences to what you're going through. I think that when you're talking to this person, and ideally they would be not a direct part of the organization that you're now in, I think it forces self-reflection, and it forces iteration on real-time feedback on what you're experiencing now. And I've often found is when I talk through some of these problems and issues, whether it's difficulty with a subordinate or a field exercise or some type of review that didn't go as planned, I think just talking it through with a mentor forces that self-reflection that sometimes most people are reasonable and want to succeed. And when that forces you to self-reflect, I think there's some natural course corrections that occur, especially if it's an experienced mentor that can provide a lot of real-time feedback.
That's good advice. I will admit that I am terrible at seeking out mentors, and I don't know if that's some sort of personality flaw on my part, some sort of sense that getting a mentor maybe says something about me or deficiencies, or if I'm just too lazy to do it. I know I should. Everybody says you should, but I really have not. So, how did you go about it? Like finding one or more mentors?
Yeah, I'll give you a few examples. In the military, I had family members that served in the military and had seen every leadership situation I could hope to encounter. So I would actually make the habit of once or twice a week, I'd talk with my father on the phone. That's obviously not relevant to everybody. But in corporate America, I didn't have any family members that had been successful executives in corporate America. So my mentors end up looking a little bit different. Being prior military, ironically, my first boss in the organization was a Naval Academy grad. And after I rotated out of my first job, having been with the corporation about, 10 or 11 months, he became my default mentor when I had problems or issues or were thinking about something. We had a personal relationship. He had some context of the company, but was not involved in my day-to-day job. We were in completely different segments of the company, but he was able to be knowledgeable enough to provide very good advice in many cases. I would say that those were ideally a mentor. Ideally, you could seek someone out that you would have something in common with or some kind of relatability. It could be going to the same college, same outside work interest, from the same geographical region or country in the world. But there probably has to be some kind of personal connection when you seek a person out. Ideally, they have some kind of connection to your organization, but it's going to be on you to find this. And I'm not going to say it's going to be easy, but I would say it would be worthwhile. I would also say that ideally you want someone who's probably about two levels higher than you in the organization. So if you're a brand new college graduate, you want to find someone in their 30s who has kind of been there and not only seen these things once, but seen all the issues you're going to encounter multiple times and probably has even mentored someone around your level before. I think that's what makes things most effective.
That's really helpful. I what occurred to me right now as you were talking is that I think maybe myself, maybe other people think about finding a mentor the wrong way. And the people who I have mentored to some degree or another, I find them just really good about asking questions and asking for help, you know, not help about how do I do this operational thing or use this tool. That's great too, but they're still self-starters, right? They're getting the job done, but they're really good about asking sort of the questions that are more introspective and about how they can improve as a person, as a leader, as someone in the organization, and with interpersonal dynamics, especially in a new organization. And so I find like I can think of a few people offhand. Some of them are just really good at that, and I'm perhaps not good at that, and that may be like a first baby step in the right direction.
Very well could be. I can tell you some things about how not to find a mentor. I have never seen in corporate America, you'll often see mentor-mentee programs advertised or something paired off. I've never seen one of those pairings be highly successful. And my definition of highly successful would be having meaningful contact on several times a month for an extended period of time or 1 year or more. I mean, ideally what the relationship looks like, I'll give you an example. I had a person who I consider a mentor, who I go to for career advice about when I want to make a personal change in a job or a company or something that's relatively big. He was formerly a VP of HR in my industry. I will trade notes with him years after the fact of not having talked with him or used with him about a career decision. I probably traded notes with him 3 or 4 months ago. And we have a good personal connection. He knows a lot about me and my family. I know a lot about him and his family. I believe him to be highly knowledgeable and highly credible for that particular purpose, and probably able to provide me more better feedback than most others can. And that personal connection just makes that link even stronger. And so, Andrew, I alluded to the fact that I made a career change after being in oil and gas for a number of years. I moved into a different industry, test and measurement equipment. And this was a person who, again, I hadn't probably seen in 3 or 4 years. But when I was considering doing this, I probably had 3 or 4 conversations with him to help me frame up, help me understand the risk I'm taking, help me to make sure this is a good fit for me and my family, and also help me understand what my upsides and downsides are around this move. And he's fantastic at that.
That's great. That's great. I'm sure that even just having anyone who is like moderately experienced and just someone outside your head is a great step in and of itself. But this sounds like someone who's a great mentor on all sorts of other respects. Cool. Well, I'd love to deep dive your experience in Norway a little bit more and understand how different that was from your experience and how you navigated being someone from an outsider in their world. I mean, maybe a good place to start would be your experience, like, enforcing some safety measures there. It sounds like that was a very eye-opening experience on how things work.
I had a warehouse manager who I work with who was very competent and very organized. And one of the things we have by corporate policy is everybody who's working in a warehouse-type environment has to wear safety glasses. And, I mentioned this policy to him and I left the building, for the day. The building was, I think it was about a 15-20 minute drive. So I was only out there maybe, once a week or once every other week or so. And I said, hey, this is something we have to implement as part of being an American corporation. So I came back the following week and no one was in safety glasses. And so I called the manager over and I was like, hey, like we had talked about this, like what's going on here? And he looks at me and he's like, well, Jay, you know, we all met, we all talked about how we felt about safety glasses. And we shared our pros and cons of working with them and putting them on and that was his way of basically trying to get internal buy-in from all of his people that this was a good idea. From my perspective as an American, you know, if the standard is put on safety glasses when operating in the warehouse, you put on safety glasses when operating in the warehouse. There's not really much room for flexibility in those standards. And so I took a more directive approach and that's not common in that culture. So you create a little bit of a frustration, but ultimately, standards are standards. But it's just such a radically different way of approaching a problem. He was doing what he believed was correct. And I'm sure if I had given him another 3 weeks or 4 weeks, everyone would have done that. But it's just, it's coming from two different worlds.
Right. Right. I guess, yeah. Like so if you see similar situations in the corporate world, there's a cultural aspect there, but I think there's a general theme that can be applied anywhere. So, essentially, you as the supervisor, as the boss, need to or want to enforce something. And a lot of times, I think the awkwardness for a leader is when you have to, right? So it's not your vision necessarily, but you're obligated to enforce this down. And a lot of times it's things like safety regulations or certain ways to report things, certain ways to do things, maybe certain ways to meet in some organizations. Because I had, you know, I had a similar situation when I joined the ship, probably just a month or two in. We had started our deployment, and I was in charge of all the deck department. And so it was all the guys and women who managed all the small boats and the place where we stored the hovercraft and painted the ship. And there was a lot of the most annoying thing on a ship are these things called needle guns, right? And a needle gun is what you use to scrape paint off, or in the worst case, this non-skid coating that you need on a ship so you don't slip off the ship in high seas. And it's the loudest possible sound you can imagine when you're inside a ship, because it's just metal on metal at high powers and high speeds, and it's just insane vibrating and squealing noise. And I remember going up to my division of folks, and they're outside, and the chiefs, the senior enlisted, are, you know, the equivalent of like a, you know, plant manager, right, or something like that. You know, they're the boss out there, but they're you know, junior to me. They work for me, and people are using these things but don't have on a respirator or some other sort of protection, so they don't breathe all this stuff in. And you know, it's like clear that, you know, my all the really junior folks out there who are actually doing the work, like, they need that. It's for their own safety. It's also a Navy regulation that's pretty strictly enforced, but they don't actually have that stuff on. And you, as a junior officer going up to, you know, the plant manager, so to speak, or, you know, my chief, who's older than me, you know, or you, like, you know, more experienced at the stuff they're doing day to day, has the personal relationship with the folks on the ground, and has, you know, some like cultural and situational power there, it can create a lot of anxiety for especially a junior leader, or someone who may be even experienced leader but coming new into a foreign situation, if you will. And yours was directly foreign, you know, but it happens, you know, even in the same culture you're in. So, you know, even though I knew I was in the right, I was just, you know, wet behind the ears as an officer. So, you know, looking back, like, I might not want to admit it now, then, but I, like, looking back, like, there was some anxiety about even, you know, how do I bring that up? And honestly, there's sort of like in the back of your mind as a junior leader, I think it's probably natural to be like, well, what if they call my bluff? And they're just like, like, you know, maybe we'll get around to it. And that's sort of like, that's exactly what you faced, right? It's sort of like, yeah, we'll talk about it. We'll get back to you. So, you know, like, what is your advice to, you know, someone in this sort of general situation, especially like a young leader, new manager, to navigate those sorts of situations?
So, it's challenging. There's a lot of anxiety around it. I think, first of all, you want to make sure that in both situations, yours and my situation, we both knew that there's a regulation or a standard or whatever the case, or something, a desirable behavior that has to occur. And by and large, you have something to anchor back on of why it is. And if you have... If you can make a reasonable argument, and you can do it in the most, you know, you can do it in an appropriate manner. So my guess is, let's take your situation. You probably didn't start going out there and yelling at the Master Chief to have everyone have their respirators on and just start yelling at them and grabbing things. That probably you're going to cause them to do it and put on the gear, but. There's obviously some fallout that occurs from that. You're going to have a pretty frustrated people beneath you. Next time they may not do it. What I did and what I would advise leaders is, you know, you pull the experienced person off. You need to explain to them what you're seeing and what right looks like, and hopefully the difference is pretty clear. In some cases, especially if it's something super technical, the difference may not be clear. And I would suspect most subordinates or most people, when the deficiency is pointed out, will react and correct it. And in the case of my warehouse manager, and I'm guessing in the case of the master chief that was working for you, they'll make the correction and probably feel pretty embarrassed about it afterwards. I think what's even more challenging is when if they do call your bluff. And then that forces you as a leader, where you pointed out a deficiency, you cited or have reasonable evidence as to why it's a deficiency, and now you're forced in a situation then to use your authority as the manager to take more stronger action. I think then it's appropriate. You can't let those things go. It sets a horrible precedent. But then you are basically put in a position where you need to be more directive. And I have never been in a case where I have been in cases where I've approached things and been kind of sidestepped, like the safety glass example I've given, but I've never had a case where someone has refused to do something after calling my or called my bluff, as you put it. I've never been in that situation, but then you would have obviously a critical situation where, in that case, you need to make sure that the desired behavior is actually performed. I would say the more challenging thing is if you see something that you think is not right, but you don't know the full situation or full picture, that becomes much more challenging, because then you're in an ambiguous situation where there's not a clear-cut regulation or standard as to what has happened. And I think in those cases, as a junior leader, you better be damn sure that you got your facts correct before you become directive.
Right. Well, I think there's a lot there to unpack. And those are all great little kernels of wisdom. So I'll tell you what I did. It wasn't directive, like you said. It was, you know, pull him aside. He was already sort of aside, you know, I walked up to him, and we had started talking about something else anyway. And I'm sort of looking over there, like scratching my head, like, am I like seeing this right now? And I asked it almost in a way where it allowed him to save face. You know, it wasn't like, hey, you need to go over there and get those respirators on right now. I mean, I could have done that, right? But as a new manager, especially one very young, and especially in the military dynamic where these guys are used to seeing these brand new officers come in, you know, every 6 months, year after year, and they're there the whole time. They're doing the job. They know the job. And so it takes a while to build your credibility, right? And so, and I'm sure there's so many cases in the private sector where that's the case too. And so, you know, I asked it almost in a conversational way. Now, and when I asked it the way I did, and in a way that allowed him to sort of, you know, take the action of his own volition, essentially, and own it, right? He was able to take ownership of it, kind of as is, like, hey, you gave me the idea, but, like, I'm going to go do this. And so, you know, really quick, I mean, he almost just, like, leapt out of his shoes to go over there and correct the action. And I think he was a little embarrassed, right? But not in a way where he lost face, and where we could be, you know, the end result, the feeling was like a collaborative team. And I think that that's the sort of feeling that I get. And I think it's easier in some ways to do the non-regulation, the non-code enforcement sort of action sometimes, because it just ends up being more collaborative. And it's something where, like, if I have an idea about a way to, you know, sort of like tactically the way we should proceed in something, right? So there's a, you know, good example, which I can't relate all the details, but on my second deployment in Iraq, where I'm sort of looking at us fail with this particular technique, over and over and over again. And technically, as the, you know, more senior officer in those sorts of operations, right, your tactics are not really your domain, right? It's everything else. It's up and out, it's communications, it's a lot of the mission planning, and optimizing people for success, like you said, making sure they're doing their best job, even though they're the experts at, you know, blowing up doors or whatever. But we failed this particular technique over and over. And so, you know, with this idea that I had, it was much more collaborative. I mean, I was very insistent that, hey, this is my vision. Like, this is what we need to do. It took a lot of explaining and sort of heated conversations with some folks. But, you know, for me, at least, that was a much more comfortable sort of situation. I don't know why. I don't have good answers why, but it's sort of ironic that way.
The one thing I will say is the more you do this, the easier it gets. So that first confrontation, right, of what behind the ears is an officer or an operations manager, the more repetition you have and the more comfort you get with dealing with those situations, the more credibility you have, and eventually you have a reputation, and that reputation makes it easier. But I think time one, there is some anxiety around it.
And that is part one of my interview with Jay Hack. Hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to tune in for part two, where Jay helps us understand how to handle being a fish out of water as a leader, how to get your people to care about obscure metrics like purchasing price variance, and Jay's Michael Scott impression when awarding someone Employee of the Month. Take care. Like his music, you can find him on Spotify. There's a link in the show notes. You can also trust him with your children. Trust me, I know. The helicopter fillers you heard come courtesy of Mike Koenig. Thanks, Mike. Few things are as comforting as a powerful rotor chop. Speaking of which, if you like Warrior Poet, you might love our sister series, 100% Indivisible, a podcast about America. Warrior Poet is produced by Laddie, with special contributions by Spoonman and me, Shree.
No, Kevin. Me no do it. Spita.